The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 6th, 2018, the Unsung Hero Edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. We're all together in the CBS radio studio here in New York City. John Dickerson facing me. Not really face, sort of half facing me to my right of CBS this morning. Hello, John. Thanks
Hello,
for having
David.
Us. Oh, you have new glasses.
Well, they're just actually these came from Ireland in a chemist's in Ireland. And you know what? We were in the countryside of Ireland, and the chemist in the front window of the chemist was an advertisement for some liquid you could give cows to help with their digestion. So that was the most important thing they were selling to passersby. But they also had glasses.
And to John's right is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. I have no story to top that. That was very distinctive.
If one of us was going to write an op-ed about the scandal inside the Gabfest, which one of us would write it anonymously? I think it would probably be me. You're too honorable.
John, what would you write about David?
Well,
how you're underappreciated, and you could write about yourself as the unsung hero. Definitely.
It depends what your motivation is. Because morale, a deep seed, or what your read of the op-ed we're about to talk to was, right? If you're deeply moral, then that could be the occasion to write the op-ed. If you were just sour grapes and not moral and felt like it was a moral betrayal of the president, then you wouldn't write one.
Well, we have no president is the problem. There's no president at the
It would be a little hard to find someone to rant against in quite the same manner. I don't feel oppressed in Gabfest land. You know what? This is not an interesting conversation.
All right.
Can we
All right, let's
proceed?
Move on. On this week's Gabfest, an op-ed from a mysterious administration official claiming there is a cabal of White House insiders undermining the president, and he's in favor of that, or she's in favor of that. That sets
they
Washington.
Is the preferred pronoun
they are in
for
favor
this person.
Of it. Exactly. Sets Washington aflame, even as the Bob Woodward book reveals a White House that's even more Looney Tunes than we already knew. Then Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation circus has begun, and it's already almost over. We will talk about whether he's going to get confirmed and what was Kamala Harris talking about. What was her mysterious question about? Then the New Yorker invites Steve Bannon to its festival, then disinvites him. Was that the right move? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And we continue to be thrilled to announce Slate Day, which is a live podcast experience in connection with the Texas Tribune Festival. We and TrumpCast and Amicus and El Gabfest and The Gist on September 29th, just a few weeks away at the Capitol Factory in downtown Austin. There's going to be a day of podcasting. You should go to slate.com/live. There's still some tickets available for all-day passes. There are no tickets that just get you into our show, but you can buy an all-day pass and get to see our show as well as all these other wonderful podcasts. And we're going to have a guest, which is DeRay McKesson, the civil rights activist and podcaster, is going to be with us for the Gabfest, which is going to be really great. So slate.com/live for tickets and information. An anonymous New York Times op-ed from a senior Trump administration official was published on Wednesday. It has become the talk of the political world. This anonymous official says they are working to frustrate President Trump because he is amoral, unprincipled, inconsistent, dangerous. This author described themselves as unsung heroes and as part of the resistance. Meanwhile, Bob Woodward's book Fear comes out next week. It isn't out, and yet The Washington Post has summarized it. The president has tweeted about it. The Chatterati has copies. John Dickerson probably has a copy.
I don't at the moment, but I'm...
But you could have a copy. You could.
And we have Bob on the show next week, actually.
So you will by then.
Yeah, I hope so.
So that's overshadowing even the amazing Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearing. So, John, let's start with you. Why is this op-ed in the Times, why has it so captured the imagination? And does it, you know, really represent any change?
Anything? How much did we not know, I suppose?
Right, exactly. I kind of feel like that it's basically this is a different form of what we've read in Wolf, in Michael Wolff's book, what we are reading in in Bob Woodward's book, which instead of sitting down for an interview with an author and then having the author put it into a narrative, this person just sat down and wrote an op-ed. I think it's worth noting that what this person is describing is an anti-democratic organization inside the White House to thwart the will of the people,
a slow
by the way.
Coup, effectively. Yeah, it's something that does not appear to be constitutional or within the parameters of the separation of powers and our governmental structure as we know it. And yet, perhaps crucial.
Well, is this person an unsung hero, or are they part of something? Is it heroic to undermine a very dangerous, unreliable, inconsistent president who's a threat to the nation, or is it cowardly to hide anonymously and to not confront the president directly?
One little piece of that, those questions that I'm interested in is Tom Nichols made this interesting point, which I thought was right. So David Frum wrote a strongly argued piece saying basically this person should have come out and named themselves and led to or be sort of the first step in a constitutional response to the argument made in the op-ed and the one made off the record to various journalists and to Bob Woodward, which is that the president is unfit for the job. So Nichols,
this is the 25th Amendment fantasy.
Well, there are two there. Yes, there's the 25th Amendment fantasy, which is really a fantasy because,
I agree.
And you can explain why in a moment. But the other is impeachment proceedings. So.
Unfitness is the grounds for impeachment. That's
right.
The argument, which is not actually high crime or misdemeanor, but continue.
Right, right. Well, you can determine any high
you
crime
decide,
misdemeanor, so you could make that.
It's really not what it says.
And I think,
anyway.
And I think, and I hope I'm not doing injury to David's argument, but his argument is that people have to stand up and be counted because that would initiate then the proper response to an administration that is as this person describes, and that to not do so is actually worse because it creates paranoia in the chief executive and it just sort of muddles things. Nichols's point in responding was if this person had said who they were, the conversation would immediately go, even more so than it already has, to a dissection of where they came from, who they worked for, whether they had voted for Republicans all their life, whether they were an elite, whether they were not elite. And all of those questions that we now go through would have taken away from the central point, which is that the president is morally unfit to the office, which is the central claim of the piece. I wonder what either of you thought about the fact that the piece basically says, well, we've kept the president from doing all these horrible things, although it doesn't really say what those horrible things are. On Russia, it does a little bit. It says he didn't want to punish the Russians. But I've heard that a lot in the course of this administration is officials saying, oh, if we could tell you what we've stopped him from doing. And then I'd say, well, OK, so tell me.
And
they
no.
don't. And that actually I find incredibly underwhelming.
Well, isn't that the conundrum, if I may use the word, about this piece, which is that in order for it to avoid all the personalizing you just laid out, John, it has to have this level of abstraction, which then makes it impossible to evaluate what we really think about what the person's doing. And, you know, it seems like, look, we've had some sense all along that people aren't obeying every order President Trump gives, that that's to some greater extent than other presidencies. But this made it feel like we had moved into this notion of a coup, which seems to have crossed some line. And yet we still don't have the specifics to really know.
Well, but I disagree with you guys when you say we don't have the specifics. We do have a number of specifics. We know, for example,
Woodward's book.
From Woodward,
and
we
from
know
Wolf's
that
book.
Jim Mattis has delayed the transgender ban that the president proposed. He's slow walked it. Woodward's book suggests that Gary Cohn made efforts to stop the president from withdrawing from NAFTA and withdrawing from a South Korean trade agreement. We know, again, we don't know, but we think we know that Don McGahn prevented the president from firing Mueller and Sessions by threatening to quit. So there we do have at least pretty decent knowledge of episodes that would have been damaging to the nation and damaging to our sense of how the country's supposed to work. And so while it's true the op-ed writer didn't cite anything specific, we do have evidence from other places that suggests.
So
how does that change the analysis for you? Does that make it feel like we already knew about this and we have essentially become comfortable with it as a way of containing the worst impulses of a very erratic and powerful man? Or does it make you feel like this is alarming.
Well, I come back to the point, that a friend of mine made to me, a Republican friend of mine made to me the other week, which is that it's really messed up that the White House should be filled with people who are loyally carrying out the president's agenda and working to do that which he believes he was elected to do. And these other branches of government, notably the legislature, should be working to monitor, check, limit what he's doing. And what is overwhelmingly terrible and alarming and evident is that the legislature, and in particular the Republicans who control both houses of Congress, have been absolutely unwilling to challenge the president, and that continues to be the principal problem in the country. It is not that his administration it's not the problem in the White House. It's the problem in the legislature, to my mind.
Right, which you could take as in the Kavanaugh discussion too. But I just want to go back and underscore something Emily said, which I think is just exactly right about the op-ed itself, because we're trying to figure out what about the op-ed has a kind of special magic or doesn't. And I think the idea that the abstraction allows it to have some authority, in a sense, the author is the every person, or can be, because you kind of fill in those blanks. But the more specific it gets, the less the anonymity is protected, and therefore it never finally gets to the final what you want, which is we stop the president from doing X, Y, and Z. And those examples you gave, transgender ban and withdrawing from NAFTA, which are in the Woodward book and not in the op-ed, are, it seems to me, not really DEFCON 5 or whatever.
Agreed.
It is that the author of the op-ed is talking about. I mean, the author of the op-ed is basically saying this is a person from whom we have rescued the country when it's on the brink.
And they make it sound like a conspiracy of officials within the administration who are working together.
It's not just policy disagreements. The way and maybe I'm imputing argument that isn't in it, but the fact also that the Times felt it was necessary to run this anonymous op-ed and the weight it's being given suggests this is not just kind of he runs bad meetings, or he's impetuous, but like that we literally have been on the brink and they've been saved, which, by the way, being on the brink is something Woodward quotes Rob Porter, the former staff secretary, is basically saying in terms of describing the chaos in the White House.
But you don't think that blowing up the relationship with South Korea would be an absolutely catastrophic act, or to blow up NAFTA unilaterally be a catastrophic act?
I think that again, those are in the book and not the op-ed. I think that.
But if that's what we elected, if that's who the country elected, and that the president has that power, then the answer to is that a catastrophic event is that Congress steps in, that there's some result out there in the world, not that like you're being internally thwarted by people who supposedly work for you.
Well, I mean, there's another question, which is that is every single momentary fleeting desire of the president, does that express, in fact, a policy preference of his administration?
Well, I mean, that's
overall.
A way of minimizing.
He's a person who is incapable of self-discipline. He changes his mind on a whim. He's constantly flailing about from one position to the other. So if he says, you know, the national color will be orange, like, is that, in fact, does that, right, is that the same as him, like, after deep contemplation, saying we should send 7,000 more troops into Afghanistan?
I mean, obviously not, because if he really cared about sustaining a preference for blowing up NAFTA or South Korea, stealing one letter off his desk wouldn't take care of the problem. And so you could even argue that these conspirators in the administration, let's use that word, are fulfilling his will in some larger way, and they've divined that his impetuous momentary whim-like proclamations are not supposed to be followed. But again, like, none of this is how we imagine the operation working.
Yeah. And so what I wonder is if this is – here's the thing that, going back to the points both of you made about the role of Congress, here's what we know about the leaders in Congress, because they've said it privately. What they know is that it is a house of chaos. And they know that Paul Ryan essentially walked up to this idea.
Yes.
in his piece with Mark Leibovich, which was, you know, think of the things we've kept him from doing, speaking him in that case of President Trump. So if they know this, this is not the way to run a railroad. You cannot have a presidency that has a cabal inside that is keeping the country safe. And that, again, back to Congress's duty, they should maybe like look into this. Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, essentially in response to the Times op-ed, said, yeah, this is what I've been talking about for a long time. And in fact, he has when he talked about.
Yeah, and he quit.
Well, right. Exactly. No. And so the point is like, OK, this is what you've been talking about. But your role is to do something because, again, whether you're pro-Trump and you think this is an anti-democratic cabal, or you're anti-Trump and you think, gee, this is not a way to run a railroad and it's going to get America into a problem when it has to face a real crisis. Somebody should get in and sort this out. And guess whose job that is? That's Congress's job.
I mean, the other thing that really struck me from the Woodward book and this op-ed, this is a week of Trump's humiliation in a new level. That's what feels different to me. Like he's being publicly flayed and just embarrassed. And I didn't feel sympathy for him in his response, but you could see it and feel it. It's like a bear being poked in a cage. And that is really unsafe to me. And so what I deeply feel confounded and suspicious about is the virtue of this supposed unsung hero publishing this piece at all. Like, if the point that you're providing this like stealth, quiet, I'm not using the word resistance, I think that's ludicrous, but like this cabal to contain the worst impulses, announcing it to the person, saying you don't even fully grasp that this is happening, is going to trigger all his worst paranoia. So all I can conclude is that this person, you know, either just convinced him or herself that, you know, people needed to know somehow, or it's like after a book deal in 2 years, like that there's some really craven self-serving impulse behind the whole thing, because it just seems like the opposite of helpful.
And Senator Corker, in response to the op-ed, said, this is why I thank General Mattis all the time, which is building on your point, Emily,
right,
which is
Mattis,
boy,
not
that
writing
doesn't
this
help.
Op-ed.
Yeah, that does not help General Mattis in his dealing with, if you believe the premise of the op-ed, which Corker says he does, which is that there needs to be these guardrails, the quote unquote adults in the room, then you're not helping those adults if you're saying, boy, there are adults in the room. One of the things somebody who was very close to Secretary Tillerson told me about his initial days was that Tillerson had been told and was trying to act out the idea that he could never be seen as the kind of adult in the room with this president, or else that would immediately get you, you know, on the bad list with the president. And so this is not helping them. Final point I wanted to make, that back again to your point, Emily, about how embarrassing this is. The op-ed had a line which I found was very powerful, which was powerful, I mean, in its sense of offending the president, which is that the good things that have happened in the administration have happened in spite of the president and not because of him. What we know of this president is that he is very concerned about taking credit for things both that he's done and that things he's over which he's had no dominion, like the safety of U.S. airlines. And so to hit him right there, because that's been his rebuttal to Woodward, is essentially like, basically, even if this were all true, and I'm overdoing it here a little bit, but even if this were all true, it doesn't matter. You know, unemployment is low, manufacturing jobs are up. You know, we're talking to North Korea.
One point that Ezra Klein made, just to build on a little bit, is that this op-ed is not in substance that different from all the leaking that people in the White House are constantly doing to reporters, and from all the leaking they've now done to Bob Woodward. So does it in fact represent something any different than that ass covering and reputation protecting that's being done?
I mean, I think on the substance, it's not very different at all. And yet the combination of the mystery, like the speculating, everyone who's paying attention. I mean, so many people have emailed me to ask me. I have no idea who this person is. Zero zilch. But like, I guess because I work at the New York Times, there's some like fantasy that I do. So
listeners, Emily's acting super cagey. Her eyes are shifting back and forth.
Right. So there's that, the speculation, which is just like becomes a parlor game. And then I think there is the humiliation and the kind of public flame. I mean, this is the emperor has no clothes moment. And that is fascinating because it's mortifying, but it also is dangerous.
Yeah. Can I bring in one other thing I'd love to get your thoughts on, Emily, which is that this week the president tweeted about Jeff Sessions. And
unbelievable.
This is
unbelievable.
This
Go
is
ahead,
actually, and Ezra Klein, I think, is right when he makes this argument, which is, you know, okay, the memo. But this is something the president of the United States said out loud, which is essentially that Jeff Sessions, I'm sorry, I don't have the tweet in front of me to actually read it. But
I mean, he basically gave Sessions, he flayed Sessions for having, because the Justice Department indicted two Republican congressmen before the election and said, you know, good job, Jeff. Because those were easy wins for
us. Those were safe seats.
It's just a totally partisan reading and interference with an ongoing investigation.
Here it is. Yeah. Two long-running Obama-era investigations of two very popular Republican congressmen were brought to a well-publicized charge just ahead of the midterms by the Jeff Sessions Justice Department. Two easy wins now in doubt because there's not enough time. Good job, Jeff. So, unbelievable. I mean, that would... Obama would be impeached by sunset.
If for any president, that should be grounds for like serious questions.
And let's just delineate quickly why. One, to call it the Jeff Sessions Justice Department, as if, you know, it's some entity out there floating on its own. B, a president is not supposed to put the thumb on his attorney general, which he does now with such regularity. We forget that. And then three, he makes no claim about the innocence of those two Republicans who've been charged.
Oh, no.
He basically says they shouldn't be charged because they're Republicans and that the timing was bad because it was near the election.
And four, there is a Justice Department protocol from staying away from elections, but those indictments were in August. Like, they were outside of the guidelines.
It's incredible. Maybe this is gets too much into election strategy questions, which we shouldn't. I'll ask it of you, Emily. I am not sure that a Democratic landslide at this point might have the right impact on the country.
Because
I don't think impeachment of the president, which is the only way he will be removed from office, impeachment and conviction, will require a certain number of Republicans to go along with it under any circumstance. You need Republicans in the party to break from him. And the Republicans who are likely to survive a Democratic landslide are going to be extremely conservative.
So you're saying that impeachment is a good outcome after November as opposed to not? Is that the assumption?
I do not think impeachment is a good outcome at all.
So wouldn't you say that's a good thing, that the Republicans won't go along with impeachment and so we won't have impeachment?
Well, there might be impeachment, but there won't be conviction.
Uh-huh. And that's the worst of both worlds?
That's the worst of all possible worlds. And conviction, I think, is only possible with Republican support of the process, which there will not be if the only Republicans who survive the...
Well, there won't be anyway. I mean, really. Unless there... Yeah, no, it's hard to... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that I do agree with you that starting off an impeachment and not getting to a conviction would be really poor outcome for the country, because it will just make all the Trump supporters feel totally screwed. And, you know, reverberate into 2020 and beyond. Whether the Democrats would really try it if they're not going to have convictions seems more questionable to me. It depends, though, what Mueller comes up with, right? I mean, everyone is waiting for that. I would assume that Congress, no matter who's running it, is going to wait for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It all still always comes back to what Mueller has.
And do you think it's too late for Mueller to say anything substantial more before the election?
Before the election?
Because I kind of do.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that the window has closed and that we're going to find out afterward, which is also weird and unsettling. Though, you know, given Jim Comey's shenanigans, I don't really, you know, that is an important guideline to respect.
Last question on this. We haven't talked that much about the Woodward book, which is what I think at the beginning of the week we thought we'd talk about all the time. So, John, you're a deep scholar of Washington, and you've seen Woodward at work over the past, your whole life, essentially. What impact do you think this book might have, if any? What's its value to history or to the present or to anything?
Because we know of he's quite thorough. All these conversations are recorded. He tends to, in speaking to administrations in the past who've had to deal with him when he's written books, what happens is at first they don't want to cooperate. Then what happens is he comes in and he says, okay, I have these documents and this memo and this thing. And he's able to paint the picture of a moment using authenticated documents and statements about what was happening. And then the administrations think, okay, he's got what's happened. So we need to participate in order to kind of try to, you know, shave off the rough edges. So I think it has a powerful effect. I think that things that are said in the book, it's not just hearsay. I think it's a 2-week thing that's going to happen. I mean, the book hasn't even actually been released yet.
Right.
So there's a lot of this to come. and it will initiate a series of responses. I think you could argue the op-ed is maybe a response to the book in a fashion, maybe not. We don't know the timeline, but I think that it will create its own set of reverberations. And also it happens in a context, which is that this is not the first time we've heard these stories. And so I think that it ends up, because of where it is and who wrote it, being a kind of definitive look, even though the president's defenders would say absolutely not. Because of all that's come before, people are basically like, this has the ring of truth.
So what do we make of Kelly and Mattis's, you know, absolute denials in the context of all of this?
What do you mean?
I mean, they're lying. Snort. I assume they're lying.
Well, or the denials are so blanket. Sorry, they're not so blanket.
No, they're specific.
But they're right. So that the truth of what he said may be, the truth of what is reported may be correct, but a word might be off, and that gives you the hole through which to make your denial.
You think? I don't read the denials like that. You I don't. Read this as, I did not say these things, and I did not speak to this person. And
in
either that's true
of,
or it's not.
Right. So your point is that the denial is not just the specifics, but the entire spirit of the, so I did not say this specific thing, nor anything like it. Yeah, that's true. They are quite blanket.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I assumed that Kelly was lying too, but I paused on Mattis just because I don't think we can tell that Woodward actually spoke to Mattis, right?
And so David Martin of CBS reported that they did not speak.
Right. So in that sense, it did make me wonder if it was possible that people had misreported Mattis's remarks, and if it seems like Mattis could have said things like that, but they didn't actually come from him. I don't know how much it matters, but David, you think I'm just being naive?
No, I don't know. I mean, Mattis continues to strike me as the most honorable person in this administration, and his behavior has been, he has done the best job in serving honorably, and he's also been pretty quiet. There hasn't been a lot
coming
out from him.
Thoughts like that, but I actually do imagine it's possible that he didn't say things like
that. Was
he
the one who said that it was the fifth or sixth grader?
Yes, which also just seemed not like a, I mean, you're
spoken like a man who doesn't have children, because I have a fifth grader who is so much more morally capable.
Yeah.
So Mattis has it wrong about what fifth graders are like.
Anyway, I don't know how much it matters, but I was wondering about that.
So Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts. And the bonus segment we have for you today, it's a real elegiac end of summer segment. In fact, we're going to talk about the end of summer, but we're going to talk about the silver linings of the end of summer. So your week is probably like, oh, crud, I'm back at work. Ugh, still hot, I'm back at work. And we're going to tell you why it's great that summer's coming to a close. So if you want to listen to that segment or other bonus segments, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to succeed Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court, faced the august spectacle of a Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing this week in front of a committee chaired by Republican Chuck Grassley. There was plenty of drama. Drama in all senses of the word. Drama in both the theatrics and drama in the high tension in the room. It's been a very performative exercise. Democrats have been rightly incensed at Republicans accelerating the hearings without having released huge swaths of Kavanaugh's record. Also incensed that there were 42,000 pages dropped the night before the hearings began.
And now, lo and behold, we do have more documents courtesy of an unknown leaker to the New York Times, who's released a lot of these committee confidential files.
Whoa. As we're taping, news breaking. Can't we get the CBS radio people to just do that, John? Did you have to do it? Or do you actually do all of those BBBs every time? That's part of your contract?
Part of my contract. You know, we're trying to load share here.
So, Emily, all right, so tell us, what's in those documents?
Well, the Times leads with a memo Kavanaugh wrote in 2003, an email in which they're talking about an op-ed about abortion and that someone's writing. And Kavanaugh proposes taking out a line that said it is widely accepted by legal scholars across the board that Roe versus Wade and its progeny are the settled law of the land. Kavanaugh said he would take out that line, quote, "I'm not at all sure that all legal scholars refer to Roe as the settled law of the land at the Supreme Court level, since the Supreme Court can always overrule its precedent, and three current justices on the court would do so." So, I mean, that was true. There were three then, four and almost five, almost certainly now. And then there are other documents pertaining to Kavanaugh engaging with, I think, John Yoo about what kind of warrantless surveillance could be legal in after 9/11. And then this whole question of what he knew about the nomination of Judge Pickering. He and Pickering have said he had no part in that. Seems like, yes, he did. And then there's some problematic language about Native Hawaiians, Kavanaugh questioning whether they are really a protected group like Indian tribes.
Huh. So, Emily or John, I assume that this entire process is still going to reach the same outcome. Is there anything that's happened so far that makes you think there's any doubt that Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed? He seems to have handled himself sufficiently well so far.
Well, I guess what I would wonder in this current set of documents, so it seems to me that any policy positions he took in the course of the documents could be protected. And by protected, I mean for the purposes of protecting the votes of Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who are the two Republicans who could vote against Kavanaugh, who are even on the board, it seems to me, at all. Leaving aside the Democrats who might have to vote for Kavanaugh for their own political purposes because they're
right.
up for
Manchin,
re-election in
28. Heitkamp, Donnelly.
Yeah. So that's anyway. But so on the policy matters, I think that you could imagine Murkowski or Collins saying, "Look, this is policy debate inside an administration. People have to be free to air their views. This doesn't suggest a rigid line of thinking, but just the kind of." Consultation and discussions that go inside an administration, and basically using that as an out. But on the one where he said, Emily, something he didn't have contact or conversations about something, and he in fact did. That seems to me at a moral level gets to dishonesty, gets to issues that might be more problematic.
So what he said at the time was he distanced himself from the Pickering nomination. He left it out of a list of the ones he worked on and said, senators, it was not one he primarily handled. They've already accused him of being misleading about that. And it was Pickering who said he didn't recall interacting with Kavanaugh. So now that's clearly not true. So here's the thing that gets me about all of this. The most important thing headline is that these memos should never have been secret. We should have known all of this. Like the notion that there was some legitimate reason of executive privilege to withhold this seems like farcical. But also there's something odd about intensely scrutinizing a memo this person wrote in 2003 about abortion when we have every reason to think that he doesn't support Roe versus Wade. It's like we're parsing some one sentence when the evidence is abundant based on his actual record.
Well, but I guess aren't people trying to use that one sentence as a can opener to his larger views for the purposes
Absolutely.
Of trying to convince Collins and Murkowski?
Yes, and it makes it even harder for Collins and Murkowski to hide behind the charade that calling Roe versus Wade settled law has any meaning whatsoever.
Well,
it doesn't.
But I don't, nothing in what you just read, and this was just you quickly glossing a Times article about these documents, but nothing in that made me think, oh, he has damned himself. He's stated a kind of an opinion. He hasn't said, I really don't think this is settled law. He hasn't said anything
right,
like that.
He didn't.
He's merely describing, he's making an edit based on perhaps a misguided sense of what the situation is. But
To go down the unproductive road of imputing, I mean, you wouldn't take the line out of the op-ed, everyone agrees this is settled and done with, if you wanted it to stay settled and done with.
But it's not that important. I don't know.
I agree.
I mean, given all the other evidence.
Yeah, I mean, we have his recent decision. He denied an abortion to a 17-year-old immigrant, at a moment where she was already in need of having it happen quickly. So I don't know what more you need to know.
On the question of executive privilege, so it seems to me that it's a pretty strong case. Kavanaugh has said, look at my period in the when he was staff secretary and in politics and in administration was when asked what his influences were. He said it might be the most fundamental part of his education. So what Republicans have said is, look, you've got the last 12 years. But here the judge himself has said, this is a really important part of my makeup. So it seems to me on those grounds alone, it should be worth inquiring. Also, since one of the things we're trying to figure out in any of these, and this was certainly the case with the Kagan nomination, was do your political views, as Kagan talked about it, can you take one hat off and put on another one? Can you stop being a political person when you go into this other job? And so since that's a live and important issue, it's another reason to want to look at this information. But so A, seems to me it's worth looking into, and B, to release it the night before is obviously, it would take like 700 hours to read if you read it one page a minute. So it's obviously not capable to assess the material in the time allotted. You said it was farcical, the executive privilege claims, but where, why isn't it? Why is it farcical to say staff should be able to, you know, edit memos and give counsel and all of that and have those discussions protected? Because if they're not at some level, then you don't get, you know, the free flow of ideas inside of an administration that you want.
So do you think, though, that, you know, what are we, 15 years later, someone who wants to be a Supreme Court justice, right? I'm not saying that, you know, absent Kavanaugh's nomination, all these documents should be released. Right. I'm saying that if you want to choose that person as your nominee and he was the staff secretary in this role, then we get to find out what he said then. And this isn't as you like, this is all in line of what we would expect his views to be there. Right. I mean, lying about Pickering, if that's that's strong. Lying, I think, is an overstatement of what we have evidence for. I shouldn't use that word, you know. Minimizing his role with Pickering, like, we can assess that. But right. I think the fact that he was involved with the Pickering nomination, can we just have an honest discussion about people's views? Like, that's what I, sorry, I'm going to rant for one more second. What I can't stand about what confirmation hearings have become is that they're not just discussing what you believe and how you assess past cases. Like, can Kavanaugh answer how he would rule about a president being issued a subpoena? No, he can't answer that question. Because that could come before him legitimately on the court. Can he tell us what he thinks of the wisdom and the merits of Roe versus Wade? Of course he can, and he's not. And that just, the whole thing, and the fact that all of this is hidden is all in service of pretending that these people don't have political pasts when they absolutely do.
Right. I agree with that. And so your argument in the rule you're suggesting is basically, fine, executive privilege, but this is a special case. And the damage done to the free flow of ideas inside of the executive branch is small relative to the power you're granting this person, and therefore,
yes,
which should
allow I think
you.
That before you get onto the Supreme Court, there should be a thorough airing of your work and your ideas, and you should defend your ideas and your work. And like, that's all I'm saying. That's it.
But this goes to actually what I'm going to chatter about today. There's a great Tyler Cowen piece about this, that there's two. One of the things that's happened with the glut of information that we have is that when you have a glut of information about anyone or anything, it becomes damaging to them. There will inevitably be something that you find offensive or disturbing in their belief system.
So what's the answer to that? I mean, that seems correct, but so what?
But the answer is, I mean, so one of the problems is that the defense against that is just phoniness. It's just to like present yourself as somebody who has no views, who is
that we basically force people into that false posture because of the glut of information.
Yeah, we force people into that posture because they know that if in fact you gave truthful answers and honest answers, you have opened yourself up to too much damage. Like you're much less likely to survive this situation.
And yeah, I see the dilemma, but I also think that it is a disservice to the country to have someone be able to get up there and say, I'm an umpire, I'm a pro-law judge, these meaningless phrases, as opposed to like, yeah, I think Roe versus Wade was wrong. I think, you know, children are being murdered and I would like to stop it. And nowhere in the Constitution are there words that will stop
it. But how do we unilaterally disarm?
Well, what's interesting about what Emily has just said is actually not, that's just candor today. You don't have to look into everything you've written ever in the course of life. Stop me if I'm wrong here, but if it's been post-Bork and Ruth Bader Ginsburg contributed to this as well, and maybe she contributed in a way that I've got wrong, but
they all contributed in some way.
So they've all contributed to not saying what their views are in plain terms, not the question of documents, because he could say what you just said absent any documents and any rulings, really.
Right. Yes, he could. I mean, the last part of it that really does feel like a farce to me is like, why is the Federalist Society, you know, the organ of the conservative legal movement, so excited about this person? Because they know he will do these things. Like if they weren't 99.9% sure, he wouldn't be the nominee. And so it just gives me a headache. All the baloney we're supposed to hold in our minds at the same time.
Emily, what do you make of this strange
but
Kamala
intriguing
Harris
moment
line of questioning of Kavanaugh, where Kavanaugh was clearly unsettled, where she was asking him if he'd ever spoken to anyone about Mueller at a particular law firm, the law firm of one of the president's lawyers, Mark Kasowitz. And it was just the questioning didn't get resolved. It was very mysterious.
And it was the moment where Kavanaugh was knocked off his guard.
Kavanaugh is clearly like, I'm about to lie. I don't want to lie. I don't want to lie. I'm not going to lie.
Play it out for people who don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it was what David just said. Harris started on this line of questioning. Have you ever spoken to anyone at this law firm about the Mueller investigation? And Kavanaugh basically went, are you thinking of someone? Is there someone in particular that you mean? And she said, I think you're thinking of someone and you're not saying it. I mean, I think the question is, where does this go on Thursday? Because she seemed to have some ammunition for whatever.
Does she get to come back to that?
I assume that she gets another round.
I don't know.
Yeah. And what is the practical... What's the practical thing at the heart of this?
Proof that he has indeed spoken to someone, and was he catching himself from not actually denying it? And then what does it mean that he had this conversation?
Right.
And why, if it was perfectly innocent, why didn't he just say, oh yeah, the other day, right, that dude?
And if he had conversations, what then is the next charge or question that can be raised about him that he's basically got an even closer connection to the president's fortunes, and therefore if anything related to the president's fortunes came before the court,
and
he would rule in
favor. Recuse himself if he's actually has inside information about the investigation. You know, Supreme Court justices utterly control when they recuse themselves.
Sure,
there is no higher authority. I actually think it's a real structural flaw. Like, there should be some way of having some committee, someone who has oversight over that choice, but there isn't. And so I think that's what she was getting at, but it all depends what she's got.
Emily,
I really enjoyed, though, how prosecutorial Harris was. You know, she's a prosecutor by training, and so many of the senators just, like, go on in these lecturing, pedantic ways, and she was just, like, going at it.
She's definitely auditioning for president. I mean, there are several people auditioning for president.
Yeah, it was hard to get there. There was a lot of off-Broadway
but
auditioning going on.
But it's distinct watching a prosecutor try to start taking someone apart in that way.
And take them down a road.
Yes.
Yeah.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
What Super Bowl weekend is to sports fans, the New Yorker Festival is to a certain set of cosmopolitan liberals, probably a lot of you, dear GabFest listeners. Long weekend of superb panels, witty celebrities being fawned over by even wittier New Yorker writers. Will Lena Dunham be in attendance? I'm sure she will be. It is a very comforting and very comfortable occasion. So there was shock and horror this week when the festival lineup was announced. And it included editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, David Remnick, proposing to interview Steve Bannon, the former Breitbart publisher, presidential advisor, white nationalist, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would call him that.
Okay.
He wouldn't probably call himself that. There was uproar. There were mass protests from New Yorker writers, withdrawals or threatened withdrawals from the festival by other attendees. Can you imagine a New Yorker festival without Judd Apatow, without Jim Carrey, without Jack Antonoff? Yes, I can sense you weeping out there already. No Judd Apatow. There would be no Judd Apatow. Within hours, Remnick had rescinded Bannon's invitation, called it a mistake, said there were other more journalistic ways to handle dealing with Bannon and his ideas, and Bannon, in return, called him gutless, which actually was what Trump also called
the word of the week.
Yes, exactly.
There is no guts. No one has any guts anymore. So John, should Steve Bannon have been no platformed like that? Is the New Yorker Festival's job to expose the New Yorker subscribers to uncomfortable ideas and interrogate those ideas or not?
Well, I don't know. Well, I guess once you invite somebody.
Yeah,
disinviting is really not, I don't think it's the way to go. I also think that if you're going to try to introduce people to, I'm a very big fan of introducing people to itchy ideas that they don't, that confront them and challenge them in their comfort, because if nothing else, it sharpens their opinions about why they dislike the thing so much, which I think a refreshing of ideas, whether it's about faith or about politics, is healthy. So then there's the question, Greg Lukianoff has written about a lot of these things and co-wrote a book with Jonathan Haidt, The Coddling of the American Mind, which is just out. I asked him about this on the show, and he made a distinction between colleges, where he's very much a proponent of free speech and not shutting down speakers who say things that the audiences don't like. He made a distinction between college and the New Yorker Festival, which is a private, you know, it's a private enterprise. It doesn't have the same obligations that a college does. And so he said, you know, it's up to them to make their choice about it. I guess just as the Economist made the opposite choice. They had Bannon show up. But I guess
that's a real cop-out on Lukianoff's part. I'm really surprised.
Well,
why is it a cop-out?
I don't find that to be particularly convincing. I mean, the universities don't have an obligation to decide that the spectrum extends to Steve Bannon, right? I mean, and all of these controversial speakers who have faced protests at universities have been invited by student groups, not by the university itself.
I guess the question is, Steve Bannon doesn't, I guess you could have invited a lot of other people to create those kinds of conversations and not have to invite him, because I think you have to assess him as whether he really is the representative of a certain kind of intellectual line of thinking that you want to probe and understand, and perhaps if you're of this mind, expose, or whether he's just coming to throw bombs and then what the ultimate possibility is of actually learning something as opposed to just creating a scene.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I think to make a couple of points. One, the New Yorker has done a very good job of examining and interrogating the ideas of people like Steve Bannon.
Yes.
Over many years. So I don't think as a overall journalistic enterprise, you can accuse the New Yorker of hiding from those ideas or not attacking those ideas or addressing those ideas. And the fact that they chose in this case not to address it in this one particular form, you know, maybe that's cowardice, but they certainly are eager to address them in lots of different ways, and you have to give them credit for that. The other point, which is not mine, which I was talking to Julia Turner of the Culture Gabfest about this.
Of Slate, I believe she's the editor of Slate as well.
But I was having dinner with her yesterday, and she made this point to me, which it's more her point, which is that, I mean, they backed off because their festival was going to collapse. Like, they would literally have lost the festival.
In other words, that you don't get credit for backing off. Well, in that.
They get some credit, but I mean, when you say
they didn't,
Remnick was gutless, he didn't have a choice. He had to get rid of, he had to dump Bannon, because otherwise the whole thing was dead.
It was Bannon's word that was gutless.
For them.
It was Bannon who called him gutless.
Yeah.
Right. Wait.
You said you called him gutless. We didn't call him gutless.
Yes. But of course, you know, but it's also, they obviously
couldn't
should have known up front.
That? Yeah,
they should have known up front. I mean, they're paying him an honorarium.
Isn't that the fundamental problem? I mean, that was what got me. Like, I'm all for a free exchange of ideas, but you're talking about, we all know what these ideas festivals are like because we've gone to Aspen. Like, everyone is going to be treated with a certain amount of, like, respect and currying of favor because they're invited guests. Like, you don't invite speakers to your ideas festival, your fancy schmoozy platform, and then, you know, treat them sternly. And so, yes, it was an honor. And that's the part of it that I think got somehow like lost on the New Yorker, that it wasn't simply that Bannon was going to come and they were going to, you know, set off some fireworks and Remnick was going to be a tough interrogator and it would all be a fruitful exchange of ideas. It was that they were elevating him. Yeah. And if you worry about white nationalist ideas being respected and honored and normalized and mainstreamed, then that seems troubling. If you're going to extend these offers, you got to think through what happens when people are going to get upset. And I think there is still, after all of the power of social media and the whiplash that Facebook and Twitter produce when people get angry, there's still a way in which big establishment organizations are unprepared for it. They see themselves as more powerful than they are, and they're surprised at how they can be brought low by the heckler masses.
Well, is it the heckler? Is it the It's kind of the elite heckler masses, which is to say your writers who refused, who talk about
and
resigning.
Your readers and your, or listeners or attendees.
And your
right?
attendees who are the draw for all those other. I mean, Judd Apatow is a draw for me. So, you know, I mean, he's incredibly creative and clever.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
So all lots of people would be like, was gonna go, am now not gonna go. Lots of revenue.
Although it's funny, like Judd Apatow also has no, it's not like Judd Apatow's ideas are hard to find either. So you could say like one of the reasons you don't invite Bannon is like these ideas are very, he has no shortage of outlets to get his word out, and therefore you're actually not doing anyone a service. I think you could say the same thing about Judd Apatow. But not that that's relevant.
But
that
it's not ideas parallel, are, right? I mean, who cares? Like, right. I mean, the question with Bannon is he a racist who's, you know, effectively denying the full humanity of many people who live on our planet? And do we want to be honoring him given those views? Right. I think the other question, though, is whether the heckler's veto has a chilling effect on future choices you make.
Sure.
Like, obviously, the New Yorker doesn't invite Bannon next year. But what if it also doesn't invite, you know, XYZ conservatives who are not white nationalists, but who its listenership might object to?
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
And that's where we start to worry.
Do you guys think, so clearly, I think we would all say New Yorker's going to do a profile of Steve Bannon. That's a great idea.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. His idea is so important.
Not
critical
his
profiles.
Idea is so important, but like, well, he matters.
His ideas
in the world.
Are important.
Well, I guess
they're
so.
Loathsome, but they're important. Yeah. But we would all agree that's a good project for the New Yorker to do. I think we also, I think there's a strong case to be made that having him speak, giving him a platform of honor at your festival is maybe the wrong thing to do because he has these loathsome beliefs and this is giving them dignity. What about if it was, I'm going to interview you on the New Yorker podcast? Like, is that more like having him at your festival or is that more like doing your profile?
It's more like the profile, but you better ask some really good, sharp questions.
And this is a reputational thing, not a dollars and cents thing. So from the dollars and cents thing, which you've argued persuasively is basically the only ruling metric here, then of course it's fine because it's not going to cost you anything financially. So therefore,
yeah, I mean, I think that's
why.
In
but
the
why
final
would New
analysis,
Yorker fans, why do people who are fans of the New Yorker feel that it is an offense to have you at my festival where you're going to be interviewed sharply by David Remnick,
right,
but it's not an offense to have you on a podcast where
because
you're going to be interviewed
sharply from their attendance,
yes,
and
the
other people who were on stage who have said they would cancel if Bannon was invited.
And the fawning, right? There's just a level of fawning that comes with the public event. Everyone is very smiley and cheery and hail fellow well met. Like, that's how we deal with each other socially in those situations. I mean, probably that's also what happens when someone walks into a room to be interviewed for a podcast, and yet we don't have to see that as part of the production. And also the line of questioning, I think, really can be tougher in that setting. But I do think if you're going to have people with racist views, you're going to be interviewing them, you better ask some really sharp questions and know your shit.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. When you have invited someone loathsome over to your house and you're like, oh my God, someone loathsome's coming over. I really need a stiff drink and I need to talk about something else before that person gets over here. What, John Dickerson, will you be talking about as you have that stiff drink?
Well, I'm going to be talking about tennis, because it turns out that tennis, according to scientists, and we know about those scientists, they say that tennis can add nearly 10 years to your life. This is great news for the sport of tennis, which has seen something of a diminution, in my view, since the heyday of maybe it's just nostalgia for me. But like, anyway, tennis players could live an average of 9.7 years longer than someone who does not exercise. Badminton players, 6.2 years, and people who play soccer, 5 years. Solitary sports goes down. Jogging also doesn't get you up to the 9.7 years.
Is there any explanation for why tennis is...
Because it's social?
Done by St. Luke's Health Center in Kansas City.
But it's so
exactly
stressful,
right.
And people are mean to each other.
Well, that's because you and I grew up playing tennis in the kind of competitive, harsh... But you're right. No, actually, Anne, who came to tennis later in life, has played competitively, and man, people are uncool.
It's really not good.
They cheat. They call you out for cheating. But anyway, leaving that aside, it is the view, as David anticipated, that according to the St. Luke's Center, Health Center in Kansas City, that it is the social aspect of the game
right.
that adds something
to it. And if you're playing for fun, then with people you know, then it really can be fun, and the cheating is not really a part of
what
it.
What is swimming? Does swimming...
Swimming is
doesn't
more
add.
Solitary.
Swimming is more solitary, but I always feel swimmers always seem to be about 106
really
years old.
Yes, that's
interesting.
Quite a good. Swimmers do not do well, according to this.
They're drowning, probably.
The solitary sports had less of an impact on people's life expectancy. Cyclists live an average of 3.7, swimmers 3.4, and joggers just 3.2.
And soccer, I'm interested that a team sport like soccer, which I think of as cheerier than tennis,
yeah.
would be, but still social.
But I suspect the answer with soccer is, well, all right, so one, I bet, is that you actually can't play soccer into your, when you get old.
Mm.
That you can play tennis. You
and
guys are going to be playing tennis
basketball
at 85.
Too. You have to stop.
Yeah, you have to stop. I mean, I'm basically
at
the, I feel like I'm going to get, you know,
right. Where,
to
no,
the
it
end
is
of soccer
true that
in
you
a year
watch
or two.
People play doubles. People can play doubles like until the day before they die.
I
as
mean,
far
they
as
could
I
be
can tell.
Actually with a walker and play doubles. And some of the doubles I've seen it's like amazing. How little work you have to
you
do.
You guys are definitely gonna outlive me. I predict that, I mean, I won't be here to collect on this bet, but I'll bet that both of you outlive me by at least 5 years.
I don't,
which is what these
I don't want any
metrics
part in any
will,
of that bet.
Will indicate. What is your chatter, Emily?
So I feel like this is a moment in which we all just should have more distraction than we do, and in which really good books are going to have more trouble than ever breaking through. So I want to recommend the book Boomtown by my New York Times Magazine colleague, Sam Anderson. It's this just like charming, but also quite, I would say, deep take on Oklahoma City as America's most important minor city, as a place with like wonderful tales. I mean, David, you would be so like, this is so up your Atlas Obscura alley of like, let's take this unlikely place and find its riches, both as a matter of storytelling and history and, you know, urban planning. And I just think Sam uses this city as a way of thinking of all kinds of big questions about American life. Like, how do we build cities? What does it mean not to live in, you know, San Francisco, LA, New York, Washington? Maybe I also really like this book because I am a resident of a little baby city. So I really am taken with this book. It's called Boomtown by Sam Anderson.
Is it about modern Oklahoma City?
Or yeah. Well, there is no such other thing because Oklahoma City was founded in this crazy one fell swoop, Sam recounts, where they just like opened it up and everyone like charged in with their wagon trains and
well,
like
Oklahoma
I
was
no this was a story about the founding of Oklahoma City. I can't remember the year. Early 20th century.
Well,
I believe. And
there's
they
the
all
Sooners.
Like, gave out the plots of land.
That's yeah, that's Oklahoma. That when Oklahoma
no,
was open
I'm
settlement.
Telling you, I'm gonna look it up
all right.
while we're
I'm
talking.
Probably wrong.
The book has been it's on my desk and I can't wait to get into it. It looks like it has all the kind of it almost is like if a book in Harry Potter, you know, where it's like all the activity in the book is making the cover on the book go up and down. I'm psyched.
Well, they've had this visionary mayor, Mick Cornett, who's really
yeah.
interesting,
mm-hmm.
Republican. I think it's one of the few. I actually don't think it's Republican, but it's one of the most Republican big cities. So
that makes sense because it's in Oklahoma,
it's in Oklahoma,
a super red state.
All right, my chatter, I've got them piled up because I also have a listener chatter. First of all, I just want to recommend
that Oklahoma City was born on a single afternoon in 1889. Under a clear blue sky, tens of thousands of settlers from all over the world lined up. And then they charged in. In a matter of hours, a scrubby patch of grassy prairie became a city of 10,000.
But isn't that how Oklahoma was
No,
born?
This is a story about Oklahoma City.
Okay,
Maybe that's also true.
This is a classic example of me being wrong. I'm just asking.
You're just like broken record isn't insisting. But isn't this how
Oklahoma was born?
He's moved on from insisting to now curious.
I'm embarrassed that I was wrong because I was ignorantly pretending I was righter than you who know so much.
But I'm just asking, wasn't Oklahoma itself
also founded in this way? I thought that's why Sooners was that the territory opened up and people from, I guess, Kansas, like, went over the border before they were supposed to. That was my understanding of how
for a little bit and I will check to see.
All right. But you are absolutely right. I'm wrong as usual, and I was wrong in a particularly egregious way.
You might be additionally right.
I'm sorry.
Perhaps.
But I'm definitely wrong on the substance of your point. All right.
By the way, both can be true.
It's true that the Sooners were settlers who jumped the gun when they came in before it was opened for general settlement around 1890. So maybe this is a story of both these places.
Weird. Why would the city? Well, I'm not going to say the word Oklahoma City again. Never again will those words cross my lips. I already the most
Some
embarrassing
Western
piece I ever wrote was about
in.
Was an attack on Oklahoma, so I can never go to Oklahoma.
Oh no!
Oh, well, never mind.
It's terrible. It's a terrible piece, but totally right. But terrible. Anyway, my chatter. I want to recommend that GabFest listeners get and read Mark Leibovich's great book, Big Game. It's a fantastic book about the NFL in a moment of intense controversy. Mark spent the last 4 years just embedded in the league, and it's a great read, and he's a friend. It's as good as his book, This Town, was about politics. This book is about the NFL. My other chatter is about Tyler Cowen, who is so smart. He is the most consistently interesting thinker I know of, and also great recommender of restaurants as well. But he has a column about fake news and real news in Bloomberg, which I thought was so smart. And he was saying that really the problem that we have in this country is not fake news in the way that we think we do. That fake news is problematic. People believe things that are untrue. But that's always been around, that there's always been propaganda. There's always been lies. There's always been half-truths. But what we do have now is a problem of too much news. And one of the things that too much freely available information does is that it has tarnished everyone. And it's tarnished the elites, it's tarnished the best people. We have come to know too much about people who we would otherwise admire. And we learn, I mean, this is a very Dickersonian point, we learn bad things about them, or we learn that their the goodness of their ideas or the goodness of their plans is not complete. And the mythos around them is not true. Elon Musk is a classic example of someone who has truly grand and mostly noble ambitions, but also has skeezy elements to him and has done skeezy things. At the same time, he has these strong utopian and admirable desires and plans. And we lose our idealistic vision of the country and idealistic vision of the people who lead us, idealistic vision of the our heroes, and faith in institutions and in people weakens.
That's interesting. In the wake of the McCain funeral, which obviously jumped over a lot of unpleasant truths about him, some of which he would admit, and nevertheless held up a certain image, I think that I'd be interested in what his thoughts about that are. But the other thing, though, is since with this genie can't get back in the bottle, the question is then what? It seems to me that what the antidote is some sense of perspective.
Right. I try really hard. Like whenever I hear bad things, I mean, I do think Elon Musk is an example of this. Elon Musk is just like, there's stuff that Elon Musk does that I don't like, and he said bad things, and he's been not particularly pleasant to journalists. But then I look at the total. I really tried to look at the totality, and just think, wow, this is a guy who has so much ambition for the world, and he's trying to do so many things that if they pulled them off, will be significant and important and admirable and So, and I think it's true of him. It's
isn't
true,
what you're talking
true of
about
lots of people.
Related to bearing a grudge, right? It's like, I mean, this, you don't bear a grudge to someone who you're just reading about and you don't have a personal connection to. But it's the idea that the distasteful, souring element of the person's record or personality is what sticks with you. Yes. Or do you just like let it wash off over time?
And then finally, a listener chatter. Again, you listeners continue to send us wonderful cocktail chatters of yours. I would like to go to all of your cocktail parties. So you should tweet us at @SlateGabFest with a great cocktail chatter for next week, something that you would be talking about. And this one week's comes from Christopher Catania at @Chris_Catania. And it's a link to a story about the Ninth Circuit, a Ninth Circuit ruling, which is that homeless people in California and other Western states now cannot be prosecuted for sleeping on public lands if there is no shelter for them available. This is a form of harassment that a lot of police departments, well, harassment, that's not the word. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's harassment. That it was very hard to be homeless in a lot of parts of the country, because if you attempted to sleep anywhere that was a public land, you would just be harangued and bullied and arrested by the cops or driven away. And now they have said that this is not legal. That if there are no options for you, if you don't have anywhere to go, you have a right to sleep outside, which is good. That sounds like the right ruling.
Agreed.
Emily's nodding.
I'm nodding sagely, or not so sagely, as the case may be.
That is our show for today. Political Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. This is Izzy's last week.
We love you, Izzy, and we will miss you.
He has been a lodestar.
He has been a lodestar.
He has been a lodestar. So true.
We have named a successor, a Kavanaugh to his Kennedy, pending confirmation by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Bridget Dunlap will be sitting. She will be assuming a seat on the Gabfest court by the second Thursday in September. You can follow us on Twitter @SlateGabFest and tweet your cocktail chatter to us. Thank you to CBS Radio, as always, for being such great hosts. And Alan, thank you for being such a great host. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will be with you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.